welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts. Just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, this is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I am Brian Fies, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader. And our special guest today is Benjamin Clark, who is the curator of a place that's very special to me, the Charles M. Schulz Museum in Santa Rosa, California, which I have been a member of since it opened in 2002. Mr. Schulz was, of course, the creator of the comic strip Peanuts, one of the best and certainly most famous comic strips of all time. And this episode, we'll be talking about the museum and Schulz and why we wanted to have Benjamin on this episode in particular. But for now, we'll just say welcome, Benjamin.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hal, tell us about the minute.
All right. Minute 53. In the pouring rain at the Italian camp, Peggy Carter approaches Steve Rogers, who sits sketching on a crate. Hello, Steve, says Peggy. Steve looks up, surprised. Hi. Hi, Peggy echoes, a small smile forming. What are you doing here? Steve asks, putting his notepad aside. Officially, I'm not here at all, Peggy replies. That was quite a performance. Yeah, Steve admits. I had to improvise a little bit. The crowds I'm used to are usually more 12. Peggy nods. I understand you're America's new hope. Bond sales take a 10% bump in every state I visit, Steve says. Is that Senator Brandt, I hear? Peggy teases. At least he's got me doing this, Steve counters. Phillips would have had me stuck in a lab. And these are your only two options, a lab rat or a dancing monkey? Peggy nods at the notepad sketches. You were meant for more than this, you know. She pauses, noticing his expression. What? Steve gazes into the rain. You know, for the longest time, I dreamed about coming overseas and being on the front lines. And there is minute 53. Did you time me that time, Brian?
No. I'm going to put a stopwatch on you one of these days and see if you're...
Your Haley Atwell is getting better and better every time, though, I have to admit.
Well, I'll have it down by the time we finish 100 plus episodes.
So I won't leave our listeners in suspense. The reason we thought to have Benjamin join us is that in this minute, Steve Rogers is drawing himself as a circus monkey on a unicycle, kind of a cartoon in what looks like a pretty thick sketchbook. And it turns out that a lot of artists did the same during the war as both amateurs and professional. And one of them was Charles Schulz. So, Benjamin, if I remember right, Schulz was a staff sergeant in the European theater during
yes.
the war?
Yes, he was. He was drafted, around the time of his 20th birthday. And went to Camp Campbell in Kentucky. And he was there. He joined what would become the 20th Armored Division. He was there for quite a while. He was there almost 2 years, year and a half at least, and then ships out in February of 43 and lands in France.
Now, he wasn't there actually in France too long before the surrender, was he? He didn't see combat that long.
Wait, you could have been in 43. That would have been quite a trip if he landed in France in 43.
Not 43, okay. 45. I'm so sorry.
I was puzzling that one out, but okay. I see.
February 45. He was braver than we thought.
Yeah.
No, February 45. There was a pretty easy way to get to France by then for American forces. So that was where he was.
So and, what would he have been? Oh, pardon me.
And so they were kind of stuck waiting. Actually, their equipment was 6 weeks behind them. So he ends up just kind of sitting in France at in kind of a lean-to next to a chateau, you know, through one of the worst winters on record by then. And he and other elements of the 20th Armored. And but eventually, you know, his half track arrives and they're off to the races. They're told to head to Germany. And so they chase and go that direction. And then they're told to, actually just go to Austria instead, head to Salzburg, and that's where they're at for VE Day.
Mm. Wow. So what sort of wartime art did Schulz do? Did he keep a sketchbook?
He did. He kept one hardcover sketchbook that we have here at the Schultz Museum. You can see some of the sketches from it. You know, by then he had taken some correspondence courses in art, and so and he already had like this natural skill with drawing. He just was this quiet kid sitting in the corner drawing all the time, from his first memories. You know, he was drawing. So he just always had this interest and ability. And so he takes this course kind of at the end of his high school years and does well in that. And so he brings a sketchbook along and we see some life sketching. What's nice is quite a few of those life sketches are dated. And so I've looked up all the dates and they're almost always Sundays. So it's like, okay, that's when he had just a little bit of time. And it's a lot of guys like sleeping. It's like guys, you know, sleeping on a cot, a guy mending his socks, you know, a guy like passed out, leaned up against the wheel of a half track, you know, one of the front wheels. So that's, you know, some cartoons, most, you know, just like soldier cartoons, just, you know, complaining about guard duty and things like that.
It just occurred to me, we should probably make explicit for everyone who's not a Peanuts scholar, that Schultz started the Peanuts comic strip in 1950. So when during World War II, he had not yet, he'd done some cartooning, but he hadn't yet started Peanuts. I just wanted to get that on the record for folks.
Right. You know, he had aspirations though. I mean, he, from childhood, he wanted to be a newspaper comic strip artist. That was what he wanted to do. And he, by this point in time, had done, had sent out some samples of adventure strips. He kind of thought of something doing, he really wanted to do something kind of like more like Prince Valiant, but he thought about doing one about the French Foreign Legion was an idea he had, which would come back around eventually in its way. He also did like Sherlock Holmes stories. I wish any of that existed, but none of it does, unfortunately. But I know while he was at Camp Campbell, he saw an exhibition of original art that included like magazine style single panel cartoons. Mm. And I wonder if that just kind of made him go, okay, you know, I could do that. I could do that.
Yeah.
And because when he does some of that kind of cartooning, that style in his sketchbook, and he's doing it on the covers of the envelopes, the front of the envelopes of some of his friends' letters when they would send them home, which we also have in our collection here at the museum. So we're seeing some of that kind of single panel style gag cartooning happening.
I've seen some of the sketches from the sketchbook. You've had them on exhibit from time to time, and or copies of them. And it's an interesting style for those of us who are used to the Schultz of this comic strip. It's I mean, obviously more adult. He's drawing grownups, but it's loose. It's abstract's the wrong word, but it's confident and loose. It's not as tight as Peanuts. It's a really interesting. You can tell it's him, but it's a different style.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. He's got this real, you know, intuitive, sketchy style. I love it. You know, he's drawing a half track, you know, stuck in the mud in the woods somewhere in Kentucky or whatever. And, you know, but that you can see all of that. Like you can feel all of that when you look into this thing, and it's pretty impressive.
Yeah. I'm looking at on your site, by the way. You can visit SchultzMuseum.org has a timeline of different drawings in different places. And I'm looking at one particular sketch from 1944, and he did a great job with the detail. It's as Brian, as you were saying, it's a loose look, it's a loose artwork, but it's a beautiful rendition, a fast sketch of half tracks and civilians pulling carts and fellows loafing on top of tanks, and it's very lively and very casual, but he really captures the mood of where he was at the end of the war there.
Yeah. So
Benjamin, I'm going to put you on the spot because we didn't pre-clear this, but mm-hmm. wondering if you'd want to talk a little bit about Bill Mauldin and how important he was to mm-hmm. Schultz, and who was Bill Mauldin?
Great idea. Yeah. Bill Mauldin was in age, a contemporary of Schultz, but was pretty, you know, was a little further ahead in his cartooning career at that stage. Malden was a cartoonist for Stars and Stripes, which was the army newspapers distributed widely. You know, everybody in uniform would have seen it, basically, including Charles Schulz. And Bill Malden's cartoons were very beloved by a little less so by the higher ups. He would be pretty frank about conditions and hardships, and you know, he showed guys, you know, with, you know, a week's worth of, you know, stubble and just looking rough and not really, I don't know, it's pretty pretty real for that era. And Malden would go on to be an editorial cartoonist after the war, and that's kind of his sensibility. So anyway, he was very beloved and admired as a cartoonist by Schulz. Schulz said he saw that work in Stars and Stripes and just said, "Oh, I'm not ready. I'm not at this level yet." But you know, when Peanuts comes along, and when he does that in for Veterans Day, which you know, in November 11th every year, except that weird batch of years when it wasn't on November 11th, Schulz would always draw a tribute to Bill Malden, and Snoopy would go over and say he was heading over to Bill Malden's house to quaff some root beers and talk about the good old days and things like that. So they had a very warm friendship, Malden and Schulz, and mostly over the phone. I think they only ever met in person a couple times, but but they did get to know each other, and we have some beautiful Malden originals here in our collection that had belonged to Schulz here at the museum. So
I think your insight into Malden's work is right on, that he was beloved by the enlisted soldier, not so much by the brass, because he showed, you know, Patton didn't like a dirty uniform,
right?
But his Willie and Joe are characters that just are immortal as like the everyday guy, everyday grunt. And it occurred to me, looking at Schulz's sketches, that I'm not saying anybody copied anybody, but it captured the same sensibility of, this is what everyday life is like for the guys doing this job right now. And I think it's a wonderful perspective.
Absolutely. And yeah, some of those, a lot of those sketchbook comics by Schulz, those, you know, those were done stateside, and, you know, he kind of captures in some of those, like the sense of absurdity, you know, like, what are we doing here? You know, we've been trained for this. We're here. We've been here for over a year. And, you know, when are we going to go? You know, why am I just sitting here guarding up, you know, this beautiful pasture? You know, like, what's going to happen here? Like, come on. Yeah, that's very true. And, you know, one of my very favorite Peanuts Malden references is when Snoopy says something about how, boy, that Malden, he could sure draw some mud. And, you know, it's a funny joke, but it's also like a very true cartoonist compliment. Like, this is definitely heartfelt from Schulz. You know, he is actually admiring Malden's mud.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Ben, it's a little bit of a tangent, so forgive me, but I've always been curious with, you know, Schulz's wartime experience in World War II and in Europe. What was the path, or how did we end up with Snoopy's alter ego, who, of course, you know, resonates so strongly in my aviation world, as the World War I flying ace? Any inclination as to, you know, why World War I? And the pop culture around the Red Baron versus his own experience and putting him back in World War II?
Right. Yeah. So, there's a story there. So it's, let's see, it's the mid 1960s. And, you know, Schulz is, you know, obviously back home from the war. He married, kids. Peanuts is, you know, becoming an enormous success. And his son Monty is building the plastic models of airplanes, and you know, it's 1960s, so you know, it's, you know, we're it's like the 50th anniversary kind of cycle for World War I is going on, kind of, you know, culturally. And so I don't know, like, if he's, you know, if that's on his mind, or it's just kind of, you know, brewing in the back there somewhere. Just bringing a little extra visibility to this, you know, time frame. I don't know. Because, you know, the Red Baron was not like a cult, you know, like a pop culture thing, you know, in the 1960s before this. And so anyway, Monty's building these model airplanes, and he brings them in to show his dad, and you know, they're looking them over. Wow, that's cool. And Schultz apparently has like a book, or he asks Monty to go grab, maybe Monty has the book, but one of them has a book of, you know, a reference book of all these aircraft and all this stuff. And he's flipping through there, and Schultz is doodling, because he's, you know, he's working on his strip. He's in his studio. He's always working on his strip. And one of the ways he would do this is just by doodling ideas. And so he says, you know, according to Schultz, he was doodling, and he drew Snoopy on top of his doghouse and drew him with the leather helmet and the goggles. And it just kind of clicked, like, oh, this might be something. And Monty comes in with the reference book, and they're kind of looking through it, and he sees the word "sop with camel." He's like, oh, that's pretty funny. And so that's kind of where it's born. You know, Schultz also, you know, he was also like growing up in the 20s and the 30s. You know, they had a movie theater on their, you know, the main intersection where he grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota. There's a movie theater. He would go every day, like every Saturday. You know, he was there watching the old adventure serials and the cartoons and the features. And he was a movie going kind of fanatic as a kid. And so he said, you know, a lot of those adventure serials, you know, he says there's that phrase that, you know, Captain, you can't send men up in the skies to die in crates like these, you know, this melodramatic thing. And he says he always loved that line. He's never used it in the strip, but that was kind of in his mind, though. He was thinking about those old melodrama serials, too. So it's all kind of brewed together to make this this character for Snoopy, who is the, you know, king of adventure, really.
Well, the connection for me that I always found interesting, and Benjamin, you can check me on this if I'm wrong, but it seemed to me that in Peanuts, when Schultz is drawing Snoopy creeping through the countryside and crawling under the barbed wire and going through the mud and meeting the Mademoiselle in the cafe, it always struck me that Snoopy was going to places that Schultz had been. Yeah. You know, it was World War One instead of World War Two, but Schultz had been in these little French towns with little, you know, barbed wire and mademoiselles and probably not root beer, but everything else. It seemed to me that Schultz really drew on his own experience and transposed it to World War One instead of World War Two, but it's the same stuff. Am I right?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, a lot of World War Two is fought on the same battlefields as World War One, and sure. Sadly, and, so those place names were certainly familiar to him, you know, as, you know, with firsthand experience. Yeah.
I have a very selfish question to ask. Before we started the show, I showed you that I have two. My dad had a bunch of Peanuts characters, plastic characters that were from the 50s. Through a weird set of circumstances, my dad was friends with Tennessee Ernie Ford.
Oh.
And to say friendship is a little bit of a stretch, but they knew each other. And I think he got them during the Ford show.
Oh, wow.
And I think he got, and I was just trying to find out, how did that intersection happen that Tennessee Ernie Ford and the Ford show winds up with Peanuts characters, the characters that I wouldn't see, because I mean, it happened like 1 year old when I think they were on, yeah. But Bill Melendez's animation group wound up having a special years after the Tennessee Ernie Ford show disappeared. So how did that relationship between Tennessee Ernie Ford and Peanuts come along?
Yeah. So it was, so
I'm sorry if I dropped. Well, by the way, you know, here's a 500 page thesis I need to know about.
Okay. So the, you know, we're getting into the late 1950s here. And Peanuts is growing rapidly. The first 5 years of the strip, 1950 to 1955, is a steady but, you know, modest amount of growth. He goes from, you know, debuting in 7 newspapers in Peanuts to 100 newspapers by 1955. So, and it's pretty steady along in there. But really that's kind of the break-even point for his syndicate. They say, okay, we'll re-sign him to another 5-year contract. Good job, kid. Things are looking good. You know, that's kind of it. But, you know, but in his mind, he's tremendously successful. He buys a big house there in Minneapolis. He's, like I said earlier, he's married. That, you know, they have kids and more on the way. They have all the latest appliances and cool stuff that you have in 1955. And best of all, that's the year he wins Cartoonist of the Year. He wins the Rubin Award from the National Cartoonist Society. And so, which is called the Rubin, and named after Rube Goldberg, the cartoonist.
Oh, okay.
And Schultz actually receives his Rubin Award from Rube Goldberg himself. So,
wow.
I mean, gosh. This is the pinnacle of life for Charles Schultz and his dreams as a, you know, some kid from, you know, St. Paul, Minnesota. You know, this is it. He could die a happy man in 1955, which is crazy to think about. Okay, so we're there. Late 50s, things start going crazy. So he gets his first 100 papers those first 5 years. The second 100 papers happens the next year. 55 to 56. And then again and again and again. So Peanuts is starting to explode. And this is just a strip. That's all there is. There's virtually no licensing. Your Hungerford toys are the very first toys. They start to come out in 1959. Kodak, Kodak Film Camera Corporation, they're in touch. Ford Motor Company is in touch. People are starting to ask about animation. You know, some of the different animation studios of the day are writing letters and saying, hey, we would love to do something. You know, we'd love to show you what we could do. Things are happening quickly and in a big way, very quickly. And so Schultz and United Feature Syndicate actually sign a deal with Ford Motor Company that they can use the Peanuts characters in advertising. It's a big deal. It's a big, big deal. Ford Motor Company becomes the major sponsor for the Tennessee Ernie Ford Variety Hour show, whatever it was called. Because it was, you know, of course, you know, Ford and Ford and Ford and Ford, sure. It's Ford's all the way down. So so they get Playhouse, which is an animation company where an animation studio where Bill Melendez works, where a lot of the other people Melendez will eventually bring with him when he establishes his own studio. People like Bernard Groover and there's quite a few that are there with him. But they get the contract to animate these little Ford Motor Company for the Tennessee Ernie Ford show. People love it. This is also back when you could still put advertising in the main show's content. That changes in 1966. So up until then, you know, the introduction for the show could also be an ad for the cars and Ford and Ford and Ford and Ford. You know, that's what they do. So you can find some of those online. They're fun and strange and great. So anyway, that's how that happens. That's the connection between Tennessee Ernie Ford and Peanuts.
Okay, that cleared up a lot of things. My dad used to tell me when I was little, I was like, oh, okay. So yeah, I understand now. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
My brain waves are settling down now.
You know, it's really interesting to me to think about. You know, Ben, you were talking about how, you know, there was no merchandise, there was nothing beyond the strip, and then we have merchandise. We get the Tennessee Ernie Ford stuff starting to happen, and you know those characters have been, you know, have been licensed and have turned up in support of. I couldn't even begin to guess sort of how many products and things like that. And yet, for me personally, you know, some characters and some creators doing that sort of thing, you might sort of wince and say, oh, and that's really when he kind of started to sell out or something like that. And perhaps it's just because I've grown up with them, with the strip, the animated specials, and then the Dolly Madison ads, all these other ads and things. I've always been very used to Snoopy selling MetLife insurance and things like that. It's never crossed my mind that was something that for some creators might be viewed as any kind of a sellout. And I guess I'm not even quite sure what my question is here. I just wonder if that's a unique experience, if you as a Schultz scholar have a different view of that and say, well, you know, these were sort of the sellout periods and this was the real art. And for me, it's just, they're a ubiquitous part of life.
Yeah.
It's never bothered me to see them in other contexts like that.
Yeah. It's a really interesting idea. It's interesting to think about, for sure. I agree. A newspaper comic strip is a commercial endeavor, full stop. You know, that's what it's for. It's to sell newspapers. But you know, it is something that, you know, as it gets further and further away from that, it seems to change, you know, how we think of these characters that we get to know and love, and we have real feelings about these silly little characters. And, Schultz, I think, kind of recognized that. One thing with him, we kind of had a rule. He really didn't seek out licensing at all. He was not interested about, strategic partnerships. Oh, I've got to get a hold of these guys over at Coca-Cola. You know, that's not Schultz at all. You know, they're calling him. And he'll think about it, And the thing with him too is he recognized that the success of the whole global enterprise of Peanuts hinges on the strip, and so that's where he focused his attention. And in time when all the other things became more complex and take more time and need better expertise, he hired people to look over the contracts, to look at the prototypes for toys. And once he got approval to do that, even for the longest time, he had no control over that stuff. So that wasn't until kind of later on in his career where he could even say, please stop making Charlie Brown brand cigarettes in Mexico, please. So
it's going to be my next question is, what are some of those questionable things that would have come along, but.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, they were just stuff,
And speaking as a cartoonist and speaking for all cartoonists, as I am empowered to do, I think Schultz is sort of a special case because, unlike many cartoonists, he never had assistants. There was a purity and sincerity to his effort as a cartoonist that was 100% focused on the strip. And other cartoonists had assistants who would do their inking for them, ink the drawings, or do the lettering, or do their coloring, some cartoonists had assistants who did the whole thing. And it was the cartoonist's goal in life to kind of sit back as the CEO and put, kind of Walt Disney it. Walt Disney stopped drawing in 1924, After that, everything said Walt Disney was done by other people. I mean, he did the stories, and Walt Disney had a hand, creative hand over things, but, he didn't draw Mickey Mouse. After the early mid-20s. So, but Schultz is different. Schultz is almost unique among cartoonists, particularly of his generation come along in the 50s and 60s, in that he was a one-man band and always insisted on that. And so I think he gets a lot of leeway. You compare him to someone like Bill Watterson, who did Calvin and Hobbes and has never, ever once approved any commercialization. And somewhere between those two extremes is one can recognize that they both have an integrity to how they operated and what they did, even though the results were very different. Yeah. Like, I wouldn't mind being able to go buy, a Hobbs doll, but Bill Watterson was never going to allow that. So, and bless him for it. But Schultz had a different take. As you said, he saw comics as a commercial art whose primary purpose was selling newspapers. And, but he kept the focus on the strip.
Yeah. And he said, for Schultz, he saw there's a story somewhere. Gosh. Anyway, he said basically he saw some like Yosemite Sam mud flaps on a truck. And he's like, if if somebody wants a character on their truck, you know, it's like, why not? You know, it's like these characters, you know, mean something to people. And yeah. if they want them, you know, on some personal object, they want to wear them on a shirt, you want them on your desk, you know, it's like, I think that's great. You know, he wasn't really, he didn't think of these characters as having some kind of, you know, purity, you know, that, that some people seem to impose on this idea.
It was more like, I mean, I remember growing up in the 60s, I had a, one of my favorite shirts. I had a pullover shirt that had Charlie Brown and Snoopy on the front and on the back in big letters that said, "Happiness is a warm puppy." And I thought of it as more like, you know, it's not, it was commercialization, but it was more like they were your team. You know, yeah. it's like you were on the right. Peanuts team, and it was no different than wearing a, you know, Green Bay Packers jacket. And I think that's the way most of the people of our generation and the generations that followed looked at it.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense.
If my co-hosts don't mind, and my producer Jim can edit this out, I'd like to take a digression to talk about Mr. Sack. Because I think Mr. Sack applies to our topic today. Schultz did a, what was it, 2 or 3 week storyline on Mr. Sack. And Mr. Sack was Charlie Brown's alter ego. He got a rash on his head, put a paper bag over his head, cut two eye holes, and went to summer camp. And what happened at summer camp was Charlie Brown in disguise became the most popular guy in the camp. He's elected the president. He's not the loser anymore. Everybody looks up to him. People come to him for advice. And Benjamin, I think I heard you tell this story a month ago when we were together at the museum. But the idea was, this was an expression of Schultz's experience in wartime. When he was a civilian, he felt like, you know, the sad sack loser that Charlie Brown was. He goes away to war, and now he's a staff sergeant. His crew looks up to him. He's leading a machine gun squad through Europe. Mm-hmm. He's got authority. He's got respect. And then he comes out of the war again. He becomes a civilian again, and he's back to, you know, good old Charlie Brown. So this Mr. Sack, as I think you analyzed very cogently, is really a story about Schultz's wartime experience.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that yeah, you did great. Yeah,
no, good. Exactly. I copied you good.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, the thing for Schultz was that he was able to, even though he came home and just basically, you know, picked up where he left off, by and large, he still kind of knew it was still in there that he was capable of that. That stuff, that those qualities, didn't go away just because he came home. And you know, he did a lot of growing up, you know, in that. And I mean, as people do, you know, between the ages of 20 and 25, you know, that's what happens, wartime or not. But you know, it really did do some things that were probably, you know, very good for Charles Schultz.
It's really fascinating to think about, you know, these concepts of, you know, so Charlie Brown is an avatar for Schultz himself, but, you know, Charlie Brown has this alter ego, and I'd never come across that story before, Brent. We really appreciate you bringing that up. This Mr. Sack, I missed that storyline completely. And we were, of course, we're talking about, you know, Snoopy and his alter ego as the flying ace. And there's an interesting thread of this idea of sort of, you know, vicarious living that's happening there. And I just want to, you know, were there some other, I'm trying to think if there's any other examples in the Peanuts world where, you know, where you've got that kind of, that alter ego concept.
Hmm. Well, I mean, Snoopy has over 100 different,
well, sure,
you know,
yeah,
personas. Yeah. So, I mean, it's, there's a lot of that. And, you know, that's Schultz, you know, playing with, you know, his own fantasy world. He's playing with, you know, styles of cartooning he never got to really do, like those adventure comics. He's doing all kinds of stuff with that. It really allowed him a breadth that within the universe of Peanuts, where we go along with pretty much any idea he gets. There's not many ideas where he goes, oh, that's just not going to work in Peanuts. You know, it's like, no, he could make almost anything work.
Yeah. I put Snoopy on the moon. So, I mean, it's just,
right.
Yeah,
exactly. The astronaut.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, do you look at it? I mean, the script ran for over 49 years, right? It was
almost 50. I mean,
yeah, so it was like it was almost a half a century of therapy, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, yeah. Especially when we look back to Little Folks, which was his kid comic that he did for the St. Paul Pioneer Press for almost a couple years. So yeah, if we include Little Folks, especially, it goes over 50 years. Yeah.
Benjamin, before we wrap up, I wanted to give you a chance to talk about, I mentioned that you and I had seen each other recently, and that was to celebrate the release of a new book about Peanuts, the 75th anniversary book by Abrams Books, which is also my publisher.
Yeah.
I just wanted to, because you were involved in producing that, so I wanted to let you plug the book, which I think is just a wonderful package of not just a book, but it's got stickers and little drawings and copies of Schultz art that was obscure and lost. And it's just a really, and a comic book. It's got a reproduction of a Dell comic book from the 1950s. It's a neat little package. So please plug that 75th anniversary book.
Yeah, it's called The Essential Peanuts. Mark Evanier was the kind of the main author on that. But we also got essays from a whole bunch of different people, fresh essays. You know, sometimes with these collections, you end up getting reprints of essays, but these are all, you know, newly written for this book. And it's just an incredible collection. I'm very proud of it. We looked at finding 75 strips that you could call essential. And when you have almost 18,000 strips to choose from,
that's quite a calling.
Not an easy task. But we did our best. We did fudge it a little bit. We cheated but we have like the essential, and it might be like the debut of Snoopy or something like that. But then we'd have like 10 supplemental strips that go along with it, with, you know, the little essay that goes with it and Mark's text and things. And for those of you who may not know Mark Evanier, he's been in comics professionally since, I don't know, the late 60s. I don't know. Mm-hmm. He was one of Jack Kirby's last assistants. He's one of the handful of people who's been to every single San Diego Comic-Con. He's hosted, I think he's hosted the most panels ever at San Diego Comic-Con.
Oh, no doubt about it.
By leagues.
Mark was actually a guest on our show. We had him on very early to talk about Jack Kirby and his co-creation of Captain America.
Yeah. Yes. For people interested in scrolling back on their, if they're listening on Spotify or something, go back to minute two and you can listen to Mark discuss a lot of his history. So
perfect.
Really great conversation with him.
And he needs no introduction then.
No, but it's great to reinforce that. The book sounds wonderful. Benjamin, again, before we do wrap it up, if I want to know more about the museum, tell me where to go to find all that info and what I can do when I get to Northern California again.
Yeah, you visit us online at schultzmuseum.org. Remember, kids, there's no T in Schultz. Also, you can find us on all of your favorite social media platforms. Our social media team's pretty good. It's a lot of fun to see the daily. You know, we share strips, we share little bits and pieces of history and other fun stuff. So you can find us pretty much anywhere you'd like to go online. And then when you come and visit us, so as the curator here, I'm in charge of putting on exhibitions. We do 6 exhibitions a year here, believe it or not. So with all fresh original curation, design, all of it. And you're going to see original comic art by Charles Schultz. You're going to see his personal artifacts. You're going to see all kinds of fun stuff. Vintage, you know, cool products like those dolls that we had earlier, the toys, and then, you know, all kinds of stuff. So you'll never know what you're going to see. We try to surprise you a little bit every time, too. So come on out.
I gotta say, I love the museum. You always got something new and fresh there. And what people may not realize is it's directly across the street from the Snoopy's Home Ice, the Redwood Empire Ice Arena, which Charles Schultz built in the 70s because he missed ice skating. It was his gift to the community. So you can go visit the museum. You can go skate. You can go have a cup of hot chocolate in the Warm Puppy Cafe. If you're any kind of a Schultz or Peanuts fan, come make an afternoon out of it.
And I'm absolutely assuming that I can't buy a package of Charlie Brown cigarettes in the gift shop on my way out.
If you meet them around the back behind them.
Great. Jim is just kidding, kids. Okay?
Yes, please. No kids. Don't smoke.
There's no smoking on this show.
Wow. Well, Benjamin, thanks so much for being on our show. I'd also like to thank our audience for being with us. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, CapMinute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.